Well, welcome everyone. My name is Hart. I'm from the Melbourne Insight Meditation Group. We're a secular Western Vipassana Meditation Group. In conjunction with the Buddhist Society of Victoria, the BSV, we've brought two eminent teachers and practitioners and scholars. They don't like the word scholars, I should add. Stephen Batchelor and Venerable Brahmali to Melbourne. And to debate the relevance of the early Buddhist texts for modernity. I'm looking really forward to what's going to be covered tonight. And I also want to introduce Peter Friedman, who's going to be the MC for the evening and who's going to introduce the speakers in a bit more depth than I can.
Here you go, Peter. Thank you, and welcome. And my name is Peter Friedlander. I'm from the Australian National University, and I have some history as a scholar of Buddhist studies and South Asian religious studies. So I shall attempt, in my scholarly role, to be not in any way favouring one side or another, because I understand this is a debate. So my aim is to represent some kind of middle point, and I will be trying to get both speakers to speak approximately equal lengths of time. It's a debate, it has a format whereby there's an opening statement by Venerable Brahmali, followed by a statement by Stephen Batchelor, and then there'll be a debate section in which they will speak to each other and address hopefully points which are of common interest to both of them, and then that will lead to a final summing up by each side or each person of their viewpoint on what they've discussed. And then we'll be opening the floor for questions from the audience to both participants in the debate. And I believe we were intending to finish around 9 o'clock. I think we started a little bit later, so we'll be finishing perhaps 9:10 or something like that. I'd like to just say a couple of things about the speakers. I'm sure that most of you don't really need to have the speakers introduced, but I'll just say something. Ajahn Brahmali was born in Norway in 1964. And he first became interested in Buddhism and meditation in his 20s after a visit to Japan. He began his monastic training as an Anagarika, keeping the 8 precepts, in England at Amaravati in Chithurst. And then, after hearing Ajahn Brahm speaking, he came to Australia to train at the Bodhinyaya Monastery. And he's lived there since 1994 and was ordained in 1996. And he teaches the monastic rules and gives Pali classes to the monks and Anagarikas. Stephen Batchelor was born in Dundee, Scotland, on April the 7th, 1953. Interesting that both speakers here in Australia, but we're getting to hear voices from really the other side of the world as well, which is rather good. It shows the global nature of Buddhism. And he settled in Dharamsala in about 1972, was quite a young man, and studied Tibetan Buddhism, and began to translate Tibetan works, such as that, like Shantideva's work. And he became a novice Buddhist monk in 1974. He began in 1975 to study Buddhist philosophy, and carried on, and he became a fully ordained monk in 1979, and worked as a translator for Geshe Thupten Lhawa. In 1981, he changed his path and became a follower of South Korean Zen tradition, and at Songwangsa Monastery, I hope I pronounced that approximately correctly, he trained in Zen Buddhism under the guidance of Venerable Khusan Sunim. And he remained in Korea until 1984. He disrobed in 1985 and married, and since that time he then moved to Devon and lived in Sharpam Community and became coordinator of Sharpam Trust. And he was also a Buddhist chaplain and worked as a guiding teacher at Gaya House, which is a meditation centre in the UK. And in August 2000, he moved to Aquitaine, France, with his partner Martine, wife. And they live in a small village near Bordeaux. Now, the other thing which you'll all probably know is that Stephen is the author of many books, such as The Faith of Doubt and Buddhism Without Beliefs. And I think many of you will have heard of that book, first published in 1997, and his recent publication, Confessions of a Buddhist Atheist, is a book that some of you may also be aware of, and a very interesting read it is too. So, I think that's probably enough for me, and I've explained the approximate format. So the idea is now that I will be handing over to Venerable Romali, who will be giving a presentation. The idea was that both speakers would speak for about 10 minutes to give their ideas to begin with. And if one speaker speaks more, then I'll give the other speaker more time as well. So thank you very much indeed. Hope you all enjoy this evening's debate. Turning off your mobile phone would be quite a good idea. I should do it myself as well. It will obviously interfere with recordings, if nothing else. Thank you.
Okay. So, can I start? Yeah? Good. So, thank you very much for this very warm and nice welcome. It's nice of me to be in Melbourne. It's my first time in Melbourne as a Buddhist monk. Giving any kind of teaching is very nice to be. You always hear very nice things about Melbourne, especially in Perth. Oh, Melbourne is so much better than Perth. Particularly all the Melbourneites, when they come over, they tell you how great it is in Melbourne. So it's wonderful to be here. It's also particularly wonderful, of course, because of this kind of debate or discussion or elucidation of the Dhamma, whatever you want to call it. This is particularly a good reason for coming to Melbourne for this particular debate. And the reason for that is because this thing we're going to talk about is how to understand Buddhism in the modern world. We can see a very clear, I think, divide now happening in Buddhism. You have the secular Buddhist on the one hand, then you have what you might call the traditional Buddhist on the other hand, right? And it seems like we're seeing a kind of gulf opening up, like this kind of sheer cliffs on either side and this kind of gap in between. And of course, that leads to many questions. Is that really necessary? Do we need to have another break in Buddhism? Buddhism is already split into all these different sects already. Do we need this other break in Buddhism? That's one question. Another question is secular Buddhism. What does it actually mean to be a secular Buddhist? Where are the lines drawn for what is Buddhism and what isn't Buddhism, right? We have to make a decision what Buddhism actually is. And only when you decide what Buddhism is can you actually, you may think of yourself as a secular Buddhist, but what does actually Buddhism mean? And then you know whether you are a Buddhist or not. And I think this is one of the questions we need to talk about tonight, is what does it mean to be a Buddhist? And this is something I'm going to go into hopefully quite a bit, and hopefully we'll have a bit of a debate on that particular question. So because I think this is a very interesting and important debate, not at least, I'm very happy to be here. And as a starting point, I'm going to start off with just talking a little bit about the things that I think Stephen Batchelor and myself have in common. Sometimes when we talk about differences, we create arguments, we create problems in the world. But it's remarkable, when you look at the vast majority of people who are Buddhist, like myself, I find we have so much in common. There's so much there, whether you're Mahayana Buddhist, Vajrayana Buddhist, secular Buddhist, there's a lot in common. And it's good to focus on that, and then that puts things a little bit in perspective. So what do we have in common? Well, one of the things I think we have in common, which I think is extremely important and actually quite rare in the Buddhist world, is the fact that we take the Buddha seriously. We're actually interested in the word of the Buddha. Now, you might think that that's obvious. Everyone in the Buddhist world should be interested in the word of the Buddha. But the reality is that the vast majority of Buddhists, secular or I'm not sure about the secular so much, but presumably the secular as well, certainly traditional Buddhists, even Western Buddhists, whatever they are, don't focus on the word of the Buddha. They focus on all kinds of other things except the word of the Buddha. So take, for example, a traditional Theravada Buddhist. What do they focus on? They will focus on commentaries, they will focus on the Abhidhamma, they'll focus on the Visuddhimagga, they focus on all these other texts which were written a long time after the Buddha, and they will interpret Buddhism and the word of the Buddha through those particular texts. And the same thing is true, I think, in the Mahayana tradition. The same thing is true for most modern Buddhists. Most modern Buddhists, they listen to modern teachers, right? Right now you listen to me. I'm a kind of modern teacher, right? And we listen to modern teachers, and we don't actually go back to the word of the Buddha to understand what the Buddha actually was saying here. So this is one, I think, very important point that the two of us have in common. And this leads to the second thing, of course. Once you agree that the Buddha is very important, He's the fountainhead, right? He's the root of the whole tradition. It's the Buddha got it wrong. The rest of the tradition doesn't really amount to very much. We have to assume that the Buddha had some profound insights. So what does that mean? What it means is that you have to look into what the Buddha actually taught. What did the Buddha teach? What are his teachings? And take that as your final refuge. It doesn't mean you cannot listen to other people. It doesn't mean you can't read later texts. It means that that is the core and the root refuge that you have as a Buddhist. And again, this I think is one thing that we agree on, is that the texts of the Pali Canon, not all of them perhaps, but a large number of the texts of the Pali Canon, as well as texts in other languages, which are parallel texts to the ones in the Pali Canon, this is essentially the word of the Buddha. That is where it comes back to her. And again, another thing we agree on, right? And that already is kind of narrowing us down to a very small percentage of the Buddhist world. So we're very close together at this point. And the third thing we agree on, which also is very important, is how we approach these ancient texts. We know they're there. We know roughly what the Buddha said. But we also know that there must have been some distortions, right? These texts have been around for 2,500 years. It's very unlikely that they will still be in the pristine condition they were 2,500 just as they were 2,500 years ago. It's extremely unlikely. And of course, what you need to do some textual criticism. Basically, you need to read the suttas, you need to compare them, you need to do comparative studies, you need to use the modern tools of textual criticism to decide what is likely to be the word of the Buddha and what is not. And again, we even agree on that, right? I mean, we're getting down here to a very kind of select and small group of Buddhists who actually agree on these principles. So what then do we disagree about? And this, of course, is then the next step here. What do we disagree? Why is there then this gulf still between secular and traditional Buddhism? And the reason is that even if you do use a text-critical method and apply that to the suttas, even if you read them with a critical eye, even if you try your very best to figure out what's going on in this particular text, still it is possible to read different things into this text. Still, it's a matter of interpretation sometimes. And this is perhaps one of the things that we're going to have to discuss tonight. How do we interpret the suttas? And how do we get to the point where we can actually get the word of the Buddha out of these things? That is what we all agree on. We should actually arrive at. So one, how many minutes have I left to go, Peter?
I've got 5 minutes more.
Thank you. Okay. Just to be clear that I don't actually go too far. So now I want to move a little bit over into the areas where we disagree with each other. And I have read a little bit of your books, Stephen, just to know roughly what you talk about and how you teach. And I think the main issue we're talking about in difference between myself being perhaps a traditional Buddhist, I'm not sure that label applies 100%, but let's call it that, and a secular Buddhist, is the idea of rebirth. The fact or the idea that there is another life after the present one, right? This chain of lives, one after the other. This, I think, is the main one. Many of the other things we might disagree with, I think, are results, are consequences of that kind of basic disagreement about the idea of rebirth. Now, I want to make a case tonight that the idea of rebirth is extremely important. It is not something that you can just easily dismiss as a cultural accretion that was taken up by the Buddha because it was part of Indian society. It is not simply something the Buddha took on faith. It is an essential element, an essential aspect of the Buddha's teachings. This is a case I want to make tonight. There's two things in particular that I want to, points I want to make. The first one is that when you read the Pali Canon, the idea of rebirth is completely integral to the Buddha's teachings. You cannot take it out. It's impossible to kind of just find some random passages and say, well, it's kind of a, you know, an added thing. It's not added at all. It's integral, directly in the middle, in the core aspects of the Buddha's teachings. That's how important it is. And, for example, if you look at the Four Noble Truths, you see that all the Four Noble Truths actually make reference to rebirth in one way or another. I'm happy to explain why that is later on, but for now, let me just make that statement, that the Four Noble Truths actually all make reference to rebirth. Dependent origination makes reference to rebirth. I know that some people will try to refute that idea, but to me, it is very obvious. This is just my personal opinion, but to me it is very obvious that dependent origination is about rebirth. So the Four Noble Truths, right? You can't get more fundamental in Buddhism than the Four Noble Truths. Dependent origination, often hailed as the kind of the Buddha's, one of his main innovations. Again, it's precisely about rebirth. The end of the path in Buddhism, the whole purpose of the Buddhist path, according to the Buddha's teaching, is to end rebirth, right? If you take rebirth out of the equation, Buddhism loses its purpose. There's no purpose anymore. How can you have a teaching without purpose? And that's what happens when you take rebirth out of this. Noble Eightfold Path. Rebirth is an aspect also of the Noble Eightfold Path. All the core teachings of Buddhism are part of this. This is the first point I want to make tonight. The second point I want to make is that it's not just that it is part of the Pali Canon and any other early Buddhist texts. It's also the fact that the Buddha elevated the idea of rebirth to something extremely important. And I will give you one example to how important it is according to the Buddha's teachings. The Buddha gives a teaching called the gradual training. You may have heard about that. It's a very beautiful training which I would recommend you all to read, because my purpose here tonight is basically try to get you guys to read the suttas, right? For those of you who do it already, wonderful. If you don't, that's what I would like to see tonight. May you read the suttas and find out for yourself. They're very, very beautiful teachings. That's what I find anyway here. And this gradual training shows the training you have to do from the very beginning, when you become convinced that there is something beautiful to be said in the Dhamma, in the Buddha's teachings. 1 minute to go. All the way to final awakening here. And at the very end, at the very end of the final awakening here, the Buddha says the third last thing that you do before you awaken is to remember your past lives. And the Buddha says, it's like turning on the light. It's like dispelling darkness. Suddenly, you see, you understand what the world is actually like. Wow, this is what it's like, right? It's something extremely profound, turning on the light. And two paragraphs later, he says exactly the same thing for awakening itself. It's like turning on the light. So, understanding rebirth is on par with awakening itself. It is actually a type of awakening here, because you are seeing the world exactly as it is for the first time. It's something extremely powerful. In another place, another sutta, exactly the same kind of gradual training, he says it's like a chick breaking out of a shell, right? You're inside this shell, you don't see anything. And suddenly you break out and you can see the world, what the world is like for the first time. These, to me, are extremely powerful similes. These are not the kind of similes used by a man who just takes on something from the dominant culture of the time. These are the similes used by somebody who has a message to bring to the world, that this is extremely important and very valuable, and we all need to take this teaching seriously. It's not about so much about believing in it. Believing is a Christian idea. We need to take it seriously. That is the message. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Ajahn Brahmani. That was a very lucid and I think also a very passionate statement. I'd like to start by just going back to the core theme. And just to begin by recognizing how Buddhism is an historical phenomenon, and how it has demonstrated throughout its history that it has an extraordinary ability to reconfigure itself in response to the needs of the different cultures that it has encountered over the last 2,500 years. And I think it's important to recognize that the Dharma or Buddhism doesn't exist in some kind of ideal isolation, but it is a response to particular human situations that occurred in the course of its history. We all know that Buddhism started in India, then it made its way first into China, and from China into Korea, into Japan. We know that it went down to Sri Lanka, it went into Southeast Asia, into Central Asia. And unlike, say, Jainism, which is one of its contemporary sister religions, it has this capacity to speak outside of the conditions of Indian belief and Indian world view. As with Ajahn Brahmali, I deeply agree that we need to go back to the earliest sources that are available to us. Clearly, we are not reading, when we read the Pali Canon, literal transcripts as if there had been a tape recorder at the time. But nonetheless, we have inherited a body of teachings that go as close as we can, or will ever get, to what this extraordinary person, Siddhartha Gautama, has said and taught. At the same time, though, we need to acknowledge that the kind of society in which we live today, the sort of worldview that we have, for most of us, grown up with, one that's deeply informed by the natural sciences and other philosophical, cultural, social, and religious developments, is a very different one to the worlds in which Buddhism has existed up until the present. So my sense is that part of the richness and power of the early Buddhist tradition is that it brings to us a repository of ideas and teachings and values and practices that have not yet exhausted their capacity or their ability to speak to situations, to speak to human lives, which are quite distinct in many ways from those of the audience that would have been addressed at the Buddha's time. But as Ajahn Brahmali also suggested, the canon, the canonical text, the suttas, do not, as it were, tell us what they mean. And this gives rise to the unavoidable and ongoing task of interpretation. Now, what does such interpretation entail? First of all, I think we need to gain a much clearer understanding of the historical circumstances in which these texts emerge. It's a beautiful idea to think that the Buddha has this extraordinary experience of awakening or enlightenment. But when he teaches, he doesn't just, as it were, read off a pre-existent insight or understanding. He also responds to the needs of his audience, to those who come to him for advice, for teaching, for instruction, for consolation, or whatever it might be. We also, in this process of interpretation, need to recognize that even these earliest texts are layered, that there are earlier parts of the Pali Canon. A good example of this would be a text called the Atakavaga in the Sutta Nipata, and scholars understand that the language evolved, the ideas developed, and we can't grant every single sutta in the canon as having an equivalent antiquity to all the others. And so in this process of interpretation, we draw upon what's called historical critical analysis, understanding these texts as emerging out of an historical environment. We also apply the skills of philology, in other words, our understanding of language and how language develops and evolves. And also, this interpretation, if we are Buddhist practitioners, and I think we have to draw here a very significant difference between the ways in which these texts would be studied in, let's say, a Western university setting, where there's actually a conscious attempt to distance oneself from these texts, to treat them as historical artifacts, but to try to keep oneself out of the picture, this so-called objectivity. I think personally that is just another subjective stance, but that's how our academics would tend to present these texts. Personally, I find these texts engaging, not because they have just historical interest, but because they speak to the condition I find myself in as a human being who suffers, who is aware of having been born, being subject to sickness, being subject to aging, and being subject to death, to death. And in that sense, the importance of these early suttas is as a resource to address the fundamental questions of what it means to be human. And a living tradition for me is one that finds itself in an ongoing conversation with the past. A dead tradition is one that just keeps repeating what's been handed down over the centuries, intent on preservation, but rather suspicious and perhaps even rather threatened by interpretations that don't accord with the traditional view. The canon, therefore, does not exist independently of the human condition to which it is a response. So, as a practicing Buddhist, I'm concerned to enter into a dialogue with these texts. As a person of my seculum, if we look at, Ajahn Brahmali talks about secular Buddhism as though it somehow already exists. I think it's really a work in progress. It's an idea that some of us have found helpful to identify with. And I understand it not just as a crude opposition to religion, which is how it is conventionally used, but I see it in terms of the meaning of the original word seculum in Latin, which means this age or this time. It's as though, in a way, we live today on planet secular. And just as Tibetan Buddhists have evolved a form of Buddhism that responds to those who live in Tibet, if we can talk meaningfully about secular Buddhism, it's a form of Buddhism that speaks to the conditions of those of us who live on planet secular. The meaning of secular, I don't think we'll have time to go into extraordinary detail, but broadly speaking, that's the case. Personally, I do not see a contradiction between the words religious and secular. And I would actually argue for the emergence of a secular religion. Religion, for me, doesn't have to do with adopting certain religious beliefs, and I agree with Ajahn Brahmali that this whole emphasis on belief is very much a feature of the Christian world. But nonetheless, religion is still a meaningful word, and I've been influenced by certain Christian theologians, and I found a very helpful way to think about religion is to do with what it is about which we are ultimately concerned. As Ajahn Brahmali said, to take these teachings seriously. And seriously means as a means to address what primarily and fundamentally matters to us as human persons. So a secular Buddhism is not an abandoning of religion in that deeper sense, and it is also very much an acknowledgement of how we are indebted to the different institutions and bodies of teaching and text that have brought these teachings to us today. As a teacher and a writer, however, I'm equally concerned to find a language and an approach to the Dhamma that speaks to the kind of condition we find ourselves in today. And this is a natural lead-in, I think, to the point that the Venerable Monk has spoken of, namely, how do we come to terms with this central idea, and I don't dispute at all that the Pali Canon is shot through with notions of rebirth, that the whole idea of nirvana is the ending of rebirth and so forth and so on. But I'm not going to go into this now because this will constitute what follows. But I think we, many people in the West today are, as it were, unable to embrace the Buddha's Dharma because they cannot bring themselves to make sense of what that idea means in the kind of world we inhabit in our time.
Thank you very much.
I agree, I certainly agree that Buddhism has to be made useful for a modern person. We have to be able to relate to these teachings. That's extremely important. If we can't relate to them, they become dead. The whole purpose of Buddhism, that is one place I think also like, quite different from other religions. It is something to be practiced, something to be done, not just something to be believed in or held in your hand. And I was just talking to Stephen Batchelor before this meeting, and you find that, unfortunately, in many places around the world, you find the whole cabinet of books, and these are the early Buddhist teachings often, and people just bow down to these books. They treat them as sacred objects, rather than engage with them and actually use them for practical purposes. And then we're talking really about a dead religion. Then that's really, the whole thing falls apart at that particular point. So I agree with that, and I think it's very important that we try to make it work out. But it's also, at the same time, it's also very important that we take the word of the Buddha seriously. This is what it means to be a Buddhist, right? When you take refuge in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, it means that you have a place where you feel you can get your answers basically. You go to the suttas, you read them, you find out what the Buddha said, you think, ah, now it makes sense, now I have something I can actually help me in my ordinary life. It's a health aid for one's spiritual practice. And if we are not careful, we will end up throwing out the baby with the bathwater. There is, as far as I'm concerned, a beautiful baby here, a jewel, right? Something very profound and very beautiful going on. There's the Buddha who promises the end of suffering. Now that is, to me, something very beautiful and very powerful when somebody promises the end of suffering. It's something very hard to relate to for ordinary people. But the very fact that somebody says there is such a thing as the end of suffering is something very beautiful and very powerful. And when you read that, you want to take that seriously. Because, precisely because the rest of the teachings speak to you in a very beautiful and direct way, you have an obligation to take those aspects seriously as well. So we need to be careful to throw out these very important babies with the stuff which is not so important. And this is one of the problems that Stephen Batchelor was just saying about our modern sensibilities often don't allow us to deal with a question such as rebirth. Is that, I think I'm, okay. It seems too far-fetched for us, too unacceptable, too unscientific or whatever. But this is where we have to be very careful, right? Because here we have two different points of view. We have modernity, and then we have ancient Buddhism. Now, it's easy to think that in modernity we've got everything right. We understand the world as it actually is. We have a much better understanding than they had 2,500 years ago. And of course, in many areas of life, that's true. In many areas of life, we do have a greater understanding. We have a greater understanding of in cosmology, in the sciences, certainly in technology. It's a completely different world than it was 2,500 years ago at the time of the Buddha. But it's equally true and equally plausible that there were things that were understood at that time that we do not understand today. And one of those things could very well be the insight had by a religious teacher through deep meditation practice. Because these kind of things do not depend on the kind of progress we have made in our present world. It's a different type of progress, a different type of understanding. And that is why we need to be very careful. And when you do feel that perhaps the idea of rebirth goes against the ideas of modern science, that is a very important challenge as far as I'm concerned. I am a person who believes in science. If as a Buddhist you feel you are a searcher for truth, then you have to accept truth wherever it comes, right? You can't say, I refuse to listen to science, I only listen to the Buddha. That is not a search for truth, that is missing the whole point. So if science does challenge you, you have to take it extremely seriously. But we need to ask ourselves, does science actually challenge ideas such as rebirth? And the answer is very ambiguous and not clear at all. One of the first things I'm sure many of you will know straight away about the scientific understanding of the mind, it is very poor at present. There's very little understanding what the mind actually is from a scientific point of view. In fact, it goes so far that sometimes science denies the mind altogether, right? Subjective experience, like put in one box, we don't understand this, put it to one side, we just keep watching the physical world. But from a Buddhist point of view, of course, it is the personal and subjective experience that really matters. That's why we are concerned about suffering. Suffering is a personal and subjective experience. It's not something that science can see from the outside. It's something you feel. So there is that two completely different worldviews here. And we need to understand the limitations of science. Science hasn't grappled with these things yet. And as long as science hasn't grappled with it, it means that there's a lot of possibilities that are open within this field that could change the kind of the viewpoints of the establishment, if you like, as it is at present. So please keep these things in mind.
Okay, let me take, first of all, this criticism that I frequently am subject to, namely that I am throwing the proverbial baby out with the bathwater. And in particular, I'll address now this business of rebirth. I agree. I think it would be a great mistake to simply reject this teaching because it doesn't maybe seem to accord with certain scientific views. But I think a bigger problem is that we sometimes forget, you know, what role does rebirth and the law of karma play as a function of an ancient society. I agree with Ajahn Brahmali that it's not entirely useful to think of it just as a belief that you adopt or don't. And I don't actually think that the Buddha reflected about and then adopted these views simply because they were part of his worldview. I think he inhabited a world in which that view was so self-evident, was so natural, that it simply was taken as part of the mental landscape of that time. And it wasn't even an exclusively Indian idea. Rebirth and something equivalent, I think, to the law of karma will also be found in Pythagoras. You'll find it in the dialogues which represent Socrates, particularly the Phaedrus when he dies. And to me, the important question here is not, is this true or false? Because then, in a sense, we're back into the whole realm of belief. And I personally feel that this emphasis on truth is very problematic. I'm not sure that the Buddha was a realist in that he felt that what he said corresponded to the nature of some reality or some state of affairs out there in the world. If we put this into modern philosophical language, I think the Buddha was more of a pragmatist. He was concerned with what we can actually do to make a qualitative difference in the nature of our lives. And from a pragmatic point of view, I sense that the rebirth view was one that enabled people in that time to locate their brief lives within a far grander vision and scheme of how the universe worked. And by rejecting rebirth, the danger is that we reject that larger, grander view of the world of which we are a part. And it's not just about, giving us a degree of humility, giving us a degree of wonder and awe at the vastness of the cosmos of which we are but, in a way, just a tiny flicker. But also, it's the way in which we understand how we are related to a distant past and how we are responsible for a future that will continue after our deaths. So in this sense, rebirth and karma serve that crucial function of locating our existence within a grander scheme of life itself. But I feel that the modern scientific worldview is not just one that gives us a certain body of dry factual information. It actually provides us with another way of seeing our existence within that grander, and I would even call it sublime, vision. That my feeling is of the scientific worldview is one that evokes an incredible sense of awe, an incredible sense of the incapacity of the human mind to adequately represent what it, who we are, what the world is, what our spirit, our souls, our minds are. And the vision of the Big Bang, the 15 billion years of evolution that followed from that, the sense we have of being in a galaxy of billions of stars, of having a brain, which apparently the number of possible connectivities between the different neurons and synapses in the brain are greater than the number of atoms within the universe. Now, that view of the world is to me not a dry, factual, cold, objective scientific fact. It evokes in me a deep sense of religious awe. And likewise, in not perhaps being able to accept the idea of rebirth, this doesn't mean that we thereby somehow reject the fact that what we are now is the product of an extraordinarily complex sequence of past causal conditions, and also that ethically and morally, how we live our lives in this moment from our thoughts, our words, our actions with others, how that will have consequences that will play themselves out long after we have are dead. So although I find it extremely difficult to understand the mechanics of rebirth, that doesn't mean that I feel I've abandoned a sense of deep ethical awareness of the future and a sense of deep belonging and being the consequence of actions that have emerged in the past. And to me, this is a way of rereading the idea of dependent origination that I don't think we need to exclusively identify with the 12 links of dependent origination, which I agree certainly imply rebirth. It would be silly to say otherwise. I don't go for trying to reinterpret that symbolically. I think the 12 links clearly specify a view of the world in which rebirth is an integral part. I find it helpful to ask, okay, the Buddha took on board that language. It was simply part of the worldview of his time. But what role did that serve in terms of how people living in those societies understood their role as a sentient creature, a fragile, impermanent, sentient creature with an indebtedness to the past and a profound responsibility for the future?
Okay, thank you. Oops. Thank you, Stephen, for that. I have actually seen these ideas in your books previously, so I'm aware of those ideas. And I think it's a heroic effort at trying to review the suttas and putting in a modern light. I think it's certainly interesting, but I also think it is flawed, unfortunately, here. And we need to remember what the rebirth, quite literally, in the Pali Canon, it's called Punna Bhava, is one of the words for rebirth. It literally means again existence, right? It doesn't mean that you, you know, the world has consequences that you have to experience now, and that you are making causes now which will be experienced by the rest of the world in the future. That's not actually what it means. It means that you will re-exist and you will re-experience some of the consequences of your actions of the past. That is the literal meaning here. Again, for me, when I go back to the suttas, that is what I see in those suttas. And I want to talk about one point there that you were bringing up before, and that was the idea that the Buddha kind of grew up in a certain culture and imbibed this idea of rebirth and karma as part of that culture. And I think no doubt there is some truth to that. No doubt the most powerful, hegemonic, if you like, culture of the time was the Brahmanical culture. And the Brahmanical culture did have ideas of rebirth already established. That is very clear from works by many scholars. But at the same time, the India of the time was an India which was very rich, had a very rich spiritual heritage. There were all kind of teachers running around teaching all kind of doctrines. And one of the doctrines that existed already at the time of the Buddha, which is talked about directly in the Pali Canon, is the idea of materialism. In other words, the idea that when you die, that's it, everything is finished. It already existed, right? So the Buddha would have known about this. These were the contemporary teachers at the time of the Buddha who said that when you die, that's it, everything is finished. So the Buddha would have been aware of these things. Now, if you think about the fact the Buddha was aware that these ideas are around, when you read the Pali Canon, the Buddha is not this kind of person who would just take things on belief if there are alternatives. He would think for himself, right? This is the whole, kind of one of the root things the Buddha always talks about. Think for yourself. Don't just take on board tradition. This is one of your favorite quotes, Stephen, from the Kalama Sutta. Think, don't take things on board blindly. And the Buddha would have been exactly the same, right? If there was a tradition around at the time which rejected rebirth, the Buddha would certainly have considered that tradition already. In one of the suttas in the Pali Canon, the Buddha says that, well, there's two possibilities. Either there is rebirth or there is no rebirth, right? And then based on that idea that either one of those must be true, we are assuming either one is true here, regardless of that, whether one is true or the other is true, regardless, it is good to live a moral life. So he is actually throwing it out. He's basically talking to an audience who does not have rock-solid faith in rebirth. He's talking to an audience where there might be some people who are already disputing the idea of rebirth. And then he's saying, regardless of that, still, you do the right thing if you practice and live the moral life. So again, it shows you that the Buddha, it is not something that he imbibed from the very beginning. This is something that he had thought about. It was an open question, at least to some degree. I agree that the majority of you, no doubt, accepted rebirth. But to some degree, it was already an open question at that time.
I think I agree with you. I think it's very likely that he took on, he spoke that language because I feel it best served his vision of what a human life could be. I don't dispute that he understood, or maybe even had, as you referred to the Bayabharava Sutra.
I think you said switch to Peter's mic. Yeah, right.
I can use this one.
Yeah.
Here we are.
Well, if you like to share that.
Okay. But I don't think we're going to get terribly far in trying to sort of settle it on that particular point, which is a valid one. I don't dispute that. But there's a passage here I have from the Sanyutta Nikaya. Bhikkhus, the Buddha says, I do not dispute with the world. Rather, it is the world that disputes with me. A proponent of the Dhamma does not dispute with anyone in the world. Of that which the wise in the world agree upon as not existing, I too say that it does not exist. And of that which the wise in the world agree upon as existing, that too I say exists. I'm sure you're familiar with this passage. This to me once again brings me back to the idea that what really matters for the Buddha is a practice. I don't think he's actually primarily interested in having, as it were, a correct view of the nature of reality. I don't think he was a realist in that sense. I don't think he was even terribly concerned with issues of truth. I feel that truth was probably more considered to be a virtue, in other words, to speak truthfully, to speak honestly, to speak clearly. And we find this in the Theravada tradition of the Paramis, where we find satya as a virtue. There's, I think, some possibility that the term noble truth, according to at least one scholar, Mr. Norman, was actually a later interpolation. Norman argues on his philological analysis of the first sermon that the words noble truth did not originally exist in that text. And I'm always rather suspicious, therefore, of this emphasis on truth in that kind of realist sense, that this is the way the world is. Remember that the parable about the arrow, the poisoned arrow, is one that starts where with the Buddha being critical, warning Malunkyaputta not to get bogged down in metaphysical questions, whether the world is finite or infinite or has a beginning or an end, that the mind and the body are separate or different. That, to me, is also something he's warning against. Whether the Tathagata exists after death or not, or both or neither. Now, to me that is again a very clear indication that he's not interested in getting bogged down into such questions as, let's say, for example, whether rebirth exists or not. I personally feel it's somewhat of a side issue, and I'm slightly disappointed in a way that we get drawn into this issue this evening. But I recognize that it is an important one for many of us in this audience, and it clearly is very important for Ajahn Brahmali. So let's pursue this line. But when he talks of the end of suffering, for example, when he defines the end of suffering, he doesn't define it as the ending of birth, sickness, aging, and death, at least in the first discourse, but he understands it as the ending of tanha, the ending of craving, the ending of reactivity. To me, that is far more important in terms of how I can live a life in this world in a way that I'm not determined in my thoughts, in my words, in my acts, by greed, by hatred, by delusion, but I can live in a way that's no longer conditioned by those powers of reactivity. We can understand this from a neurobiological point of view as understanding craving to be essentially a deeply embedded survival mechanism that has proven to be enormously successful in bringing human beings to the point where they are now. And I feel that the Buddha was extraordinarily prescient in understanding that the power or the force of such drives is so overwhelming is, from a modern point of view, precisely because that was the driving force of evolution itself. The Buddha's teaching, I think, is relevant to us today, to get back to our original topic, because it allows us to find a way of being, of living as a human being, in which we're no longer the puppets or the victims of such neurobiological reactivity. And the freedom that he speaks of is not a freedom from suffering. Suffering is something that will be part of our existence as long as we're embodied in this body, but a freedom from reactivity, a freedom from grasping, from hatred, from fear. These are the sources of the suffering of our world. And such forces now are no longer restricted to our own personal distress and anxiety and inner pain. But these forces now have become institutionalized, have become embodied in the structures of consumerism, in the structures of militarization, all of the forces that threaten to destroy the kind of planet that we currently inhabit. So to me, the whole business of reincarnation does not actually address what I feel is the core of our sense of what suffering entails in this world today. And his analysis of reactivity, of craving and grasping, is not a metaphysical theory of how suffering came about, but pragmatically, reactivity and craving are what inhibit or prevent us from letting go of those patterns of behavior in a way that we can then enter the stream of the Eightfold Path in such a way that both individually and communally we can optimally flourish.
Okay, so first of all, in the spirit of understanding, I certainly agree that the problem of craving is important. I agree with that. And I think this is very much what the Buddhist path is about. It's about the gradual overcoming of craving. It's part of purification, right, where you gradually purify yourself. And one of the most important things, of course, that we do purify ourselves from is craving. So I, certainly, it is very, very important to... But that does not mean that the idea of rebirth is not important. These are two quite separate issues. You may agree that craving is important to overcome and also that rebirth is important. And I want to, when Stephen Batchelor, he says that it is just a metaphysical theory, the idea of rebirth. Well, that is not how the Buddha presents it. The Buddha presents it as an experience. An experience is not a metaphysical theory. Metaphysical theory is some kind of airy-fairy idea in your head which may or may not have any grounding in reality. But he experienced this, right? So if you experience the color red and you go to other people and you say, oh, I experienced red, and you come to somebody who's colorblind, who's never experienced red, they can't just tell you that it's a metaphysical theory, right? Because you have that experience for yourself. From a Buddhist point of view, this is not metaphysics. This is an insight that somebody had 2,500 years ago. That's quite a different thing here. But let us talk instead about the importance of rebirth, why it actually matters. Because I am always concerned about when we say that it is a metaphysical theory or whether it's true or false, it doesn't matter for our society. I think that is vastly wrong. It is not actually correct. I think it is extremely important. And this is precisely what I was trying to get at during my introduction. The Buddha said it's like breaking out of a shell, right? Suddenly you see the world, you understand what's going on. And you have to understand what is going on. You have to see things in the right way to be able to react in a rational way according to that reality. It's a bit like if you want to invest on the stock market, right? And you think that one stock is going to go up, but you're completely deluded. You've got completely the wrong information. And you invest all your money there, you're going to lose your money because you are acting based on wrong information. But if you have inside information, right, which of course is illegal, and then you invest on that basis, then maybe you can make heaps of money. Of course, yeah. So the point there is that the view matters. Your actions depend on your views. And it's exactly the same thing with Buddhism. If you have an idea of rebirth, you understand that the mind you have in this life is a mind that you're going to have to take with you into the future. Now, how are you going to treat your mind? Are you going to purify it? Are you going to make it more beautiful? Are you going to try to have more metta, compassion, peace, tranquility, understanding, morality in your mind? Or are you going to defile your mind by being stupid in this life? And the more idea you have that this is something you're going to have to take with you into the future, the more basis you have for practicing in the right way in this life. It is very obvious when you think about it. This mind is going to go into the future. I don't want to defile this mind. I don't want to have a dark and depressed mind. I want to have something beautiful, light, and something which is wonderful to live with, so I can bring that with me into the future as well. That is the first thing, why the idea of rebirth actually is tremendously important. The second reason, of course, and this is where we come to the more profound aspects of what Buddhism is about, that once you see rebirth, and of course, this is one of the points the Buddha is making when he's talking about the three knowledges. Once you see rebirth, that is when awakening becomes possible for the Buddha. So in other words, you see rebirth, and you see how terrible it is, right? Going around and around, doing the same thing in life after life, making the same mistakes again and again, having to grow up, having to argue with your parents. Then you become a parent, now you have to argue with your kids, right? You see the reverse side of the coin. And having to go to university, every time it seems so important. If you've been to university a million times, it doesn't seem so important anymore, right? Your career, wow, I got to make this career, I got to make heaps of money or whatever. If you've done this a million times before, it becomes kind of ridiculous after a while. I don't want to do this anymore. So there's something very, very powerful going on when you understand the idea of rebirth. And of course, having a sense of confidence that there is rebirth, having a sense of, I don't want to use the word faith because I think it's inaccurate in Buddhism. Let's use confidence. That's only the beginning here. But then seeing it for yourself, that is the real, real powerful breakthrough. It's like, oh, wow, this is what it really means. And then it has a tremendous effect on your life. And this is, for me, why it does matter. It's not just a metaphysical thing. It actually has direct effect on how we think and how we live our lives in the present.
I can appreciate that. I can understand that. And I know many of my Buddhist friends, not only in the West, but particularly in Asia, for them that does it have effectively that consequence in how they live. But the difficulty, I think, for many people today is that we're making a claim when, okay, let's say the Buddha does experience rebirth and that his past lives and so on. But at the same time, we find ourselves having to recognize that we're making an empirical truth claim. We're claiming that the human organism, as we have come to understand it through evolution, through neuroscience, and so forth and so on, that there is an element, an absolutely central element to the human being that is capable of surviving physical death. Now, this is a claim that I personally find very difficult to understand. And also, to be quite frank, I do not find that vision of multiple lifetimes and so on does give me the sort of vision and passion to live in the way you describe. I find it simply leaves me rather cold. I find, on the contrary, that the more that we open our minds through attention, through mindfulness, through awareness, through concentration, through metta, through karuna, we find ourselves increasingly sensitized to the dukkha of our own existence, to the dukkha of our society, the dukkha of our world. And I feel that what the Buddha's teaching is all about, really, is how can we respond to that dukkha in a way that we do not exacerbate it, we do not somehow intensify it, in a way that it actually leads us to a life in which the virtues of, which I've just listed really, become the central part of what we are concerned with. We seek to live a life here and now, a life about which we are certain, that has occurred on this planet. We seek to dedicate our lives as fully as we possibly can to realizing and cultivating the virtues of that path. And if there is a future life, and I wouldn't rule it out, ultimately, I don't know. And I think it would be dogmatic and metaphysical to deny rebirth. That's just the opposite side of the coin, really. I feel that it's a question, really, of being able to hold that question open. If one were to live this life according to the precepts of the four noble tasks, as I prefer to call them, rather than truths, to live a life that is committed to the values of the Buddha and the Dhamma and the Sangha, then if there were to be a life that follows this, I could not think of a better way to prepare for it. I don't need to have a view or a vision or a belief or whatever we call it that such a thing is necessarily the case, but I do need to try to live this life to the full within the framework of the Buddhist values and practices that, as a Buddhist, I am deeply committed to. And if there is no rebirth, which I consider also a possibility, then I will have lived the fullest and most hopefully compassionate and wise life that I can have done. So that kind of view to me puts us in a win-win situation. And again, I think if you go back to the Kalama Sutta, you alluded to it earlier on, Bhante, there is this passage where the Buddha himself says, if there is no life after death, if there is no law of karma, then to practice his teaching of Basically, it boils down to ridding oneself of greed, hatred, delusion, cultivating loving kindness, compassion, and so on. That is the way to lead a full human life. And personally, I find that quite adequate. I find that enough. And I don't really see any need to labor the issue of what it is that occurs after death, what will continue after death. Again, it's easy to say, when you die, I want to die with a pure mind that I will take into a future life. Frankly, I don't know what that means. I'm concerned, therefore, as a secular Buddhist, if we want to flag that word, to live fully and optimally here and now, dealing with the suffering that I know to exist, namely my own, that of other beings, of the world, rather than live a life according to future existences about which, personally, I can never be certain.
Okay. So, again, I certainly agree with what you're saying. The idea that we have to live a good life here and now makes very good sense to me. I fully agree with that. And no doubt you will get a good read if that happens. I'm being naughty here. I apologize, Stephen. And if there is no rebirth, you have lived a good life anyway, right? So I agree with you. I'm not claiming to know myself. But I'm open to other possibilities as well. But I think the point here for me, rather, is that we consider ourselves disciples of the Buddha, right? We call ourselves Buddhists. That means something to call ourselves Buddhist. It doesn't mean that we can just think, you can just choose any theory, any idea, and call that Buddhism. There's a certain responsibility that comes with calling yourself Buddhist. And that responsibility, particularly as a teacher, is to actually teach those teachings of the Buddha according to how he taught them. So if we see in the Pali Canon that there is no doubt that the Buddha taught rebirth, then we have to take that seriously. The Buddha took it very seriously. For him, it was an extremely important teaching. Maybe it's hard for us to understand why it's important. Maybe it is just our own limitations which come into place, right? And this is where it is so beautiful sometimes to have a teacher who has a larger view than you have. There's a certain humility in that, in accepting there might be somebody out there who knows more than us. When we go to university, we go to medical school, we assume that the professor knows more than us, right? So we listen, we take it on board. We don't criticize everything and put down everything the professor says. And that is true in all professions. And it should also be true in the spiritual profession. If we are disciples of the Buddha, and that means, you call yourself a Buddhist, a secular Buddhist is still a Buddhist, so you're still a disciple of the Buddha in that sense, there's an obligation there to actually teach what the Buddha taught and not to deviate too far from that truth, that teaching, and then assume that he taught it exactly as it says because it is extremely important for awakening. And I think it is. I think that if you, the more that conviction of rebirth settles down inside of you, the more you understand the enormity of the thing that you have to do to overcome this. And I think that one of the things I said I wanted to talk about tonight before when I spoke to Hart, was about monasticism and the idea of awakening as well. And of course, for me, the idea of monasticism often comes into the fore when we are talking about rebirth. That is when it becomes so important, because suddenly your priorities change so enormously. You're willing to put in more effort, you're willing to commit yourself even further than you otherwise would. And monastic life really becomes significant and important in the light of rebirth and in the light of the ending of rebirth, which is awakening. But my main point is, as disciples of the Buddha, we have an obligation to take the word of the Buddha seriously and not easily dismiss those things. And this is really, for me, the bottom line. If he taught rebirth, for me, there must be something very important there.
Thank you. Well, I take exception to the fact that you suggest that I easily dismiss these things. That's not true. I spent many years as a Tibetan Buddhist monk struggling to understand this doctrine of rebirth. And it led me to experiences when I woke up in the middle of the night in a cold sweat because I found I could not, in good faith, not confidence, let's say, actually accept that. I was taught, again, within a Buddhist tradition that laid great emphasis on the importance of critical analysis of the Buddha's teaching. This was the Gelugpa school of Tibetan Buddhism. I was trained in debate. I was trained in logic. And one of the key points that my teachers insisted that we needed to come to some conviction about was the doctrine of rebirth. I was told, and I believed as a young monk for many years, that if I could not accept that view, I could not consider myself a disciple of the Buddha. Now, the crisis that I underwent was because I couldn't mesh those two injunctions. To read, to analyze the text critically, on the one hand, and to believe, basically, in the doctrine of rebirth on the other. And this led me to a crisis in my Buddhist life. You see, the crisis was that I was deeply committed to the practice of the Dharma, that for me this meant everything, and it still does. And my readings of the Pali texts have only deepened that commitment that I feel. And yet I also have to be, I feel I have to be, I have to honor reason. I have to honor evidence. I have to honor reflection. And to me, that is to follow the Buddha's injunctions and the Buddha's teaching. I don't, and I'm sure you would agree, that he didn't expect his disciples just to sort of uncritically accept everything he said. I'd be very surprised if that is what you would believe. He wanted people to become autonomous. He used this term, aparapatya, to become independent of others in one's understanding. My vision of the Buddha's teaching is that he sought to liberate people from a slavish dependence upon the authority of others. He wanted people to live a free life. He wanted people, once they had, or particularly the monks in this case, once they had undergone their initial training, to go forth into the world for the welfare of the many, for the benefit of the many, and let no two of you follow the same path. My sense of the Sangha is not of a group of people who all believe to the same thing, but rather a group, a community that is committed to a broad core set of values that they seek to realize in the context of the world in which we live today. And I find it quite disappointing, to put it mildly, that people will declare that I am not a Buddhist, that Stephen Batchelor cannot be a Buddhist, because he doesn't accept one particular doctrine, and admittedly a doctrine that is there right through the text, I'm not disputing that, and yet somehow that disqualifies me from being a follower of the Dharma and the disciple of the Buddha. I personally find that unacceptable.
Well, first of all, allow me to apologize for having dismissed you out of hand like that. That was not my intention. It's just, this is what comes out sometimes. So I apologize for that. And I did actually read about your soul searching regarding rebirth in one of your books. So I knew that already, actually, to some extent. But to me, again, it comes back to this idea that a Buddhist has to be something, right? There has to be a meaning behind the idea of being a Buddhist. And one of the main meanings must be that we take the word of the Buddha seriously. If one of the most foundational things of Buddhism, one of the most important teachings of the Buddha, are not dismissed out of hand, that was a crude way of putting it, are rejected because one feels one cannot accept it, even that to me is enough to say that, okay, I'm... Unless you take the word of the Buddha seriously, to me, you cannot really be at least a full Buddhist in that sense. That's how it seems to me. I apologize if this hurts you, Stephen. I don't mean it as a hurtful thing. But to me, that is exactly what it is to be a Buddhist, that you have a sense of taking this teaching seriously. And if something as central as that is then said, I cannot believe it, I think that's fair enough. I think it's important to be true to oneself. If I felt the same thing, I would go the same way. You have to be true to yourself. You cannot pretend that you have confidence. It's something you have in the confidence too. But then you also have to take the consequences of that. And one of the consequences of that is to say, I'm a secular person with leaning to Buddhism or something like that, rather than actually calling it a secular Buddhist. To me, you are no longer Buddhist at the point when you, one of the most core teachings of Buddhism, when you decide that that needs to be rejected.
I think the most important thing that's happening at the moment is not whether I am right or whether Ajahn Brahmali is right, but that this conversation is happening. And to me, this is illustrative of the health and the vitality of the Dhamma as it finds its way into a new environment. And without these kinds of discussions, even if we, in the end up disagreeing totally, I still feel that this is an illustration, an example of the Dhamma finding its way by fits and starts, comfortably and uncomfortably, with disputes and with debates and so on, into an environment, that of the of modernity, that it is yet to find its role. And I really hope that we do not take these disagreements as the basis for just increasing further a sectarian distance by, as it were, excluding people from the notion of being really Buddhist on the grounds of a particular belief. I think the important thing is to honor the integrity and the level of commitment and passion and concern to do exactly what you say, to take the Buddha's words seriously. I believe I do that. He doesn't. That will probably remain a point of contention between us. I'm also totally open to the fact that my meditation practice may lead me to reconsider what I'm saying now. My whole process of being a Buddhist is a process of an ongoing discovery. The worst thing, I think, is to get to a position where I hold on to a view that I know what Buddhism is and you don't. I think we need to accept and celebrate the differences that bring us together in this space this evening, and to envisage a community that is inclusive rather than exclusive, that is willing to confront one another with honesty and kindness and wisdom, to debate these issues in a heartfelt and in a hopefully a deep way. And that to me is how the Dhamma can perhaps most fruitfully begin to engage us in a personal way at the deepest level, and also set examples of a human life that may reverberate then through our society, through our world, that I feel to be in desperate need of the kind of wisdom, the kind of practice that is articulated so beautifully, particularly in the early Buddhist texts. And I guess that's probably my summary.
What I want to do is very simply just to reiterate the points that I see as important here, the things that I think are the essence of the issue. And the essence of the issue for me is basically that the Buddha, no doubt, taught rebirth. You see this again and again in the suttas. And I think many of the differences that I've had with people who call them secular Buddhists are rooted actually in this one issue. This issue turns so many things around. The idea of awakening, the idea of whether monasticism is important, the idea of how craving relates to the end of suffering. All of these things, I actually have a very, the idea of rebirth is very important in these things. And because of that, it affects our whole outlook on what Buddhism is about. So for this reason, it actually is extremely important. So I would recommend you, if you have a chance, read the word of the Buddha for yourself. It's often so inspiring and so beautiful. Often when I read it, I feel incredibly inspired afterwards. And you want to practice this path. You gain a sense of confidence that this is real. Because so much of the other things, apart from rebirth, are so powerful. It also leads you to have a sense of confidence and conviction that this too may actually be right. If a person of such stature, If a person of such wisdom said this, he wouldn't say it blindly without reason. If he said it, I need to take it seriously. That is the most important thing for me. And then you read the suttas, and again, just to say it one more time, because I think it is so powerful, the idea that, you know, the Buddha says, seeing rebirth for yourself is like turning on the light, like dispelling darkness, right? Now I can see. It is so powerful to me. And it's like breaking out of the shell, right? Now I can understand the world for what it is. It is very hard sometimes for us to perhaps appreciate the importance of these teachings. But when the Buddha says that this is what you, how you feel when you see these things, then that for me is something very powerful and very important to take on board. Thank you.
My question is to Ajahn Brahmali. In your talk, you made mention of the fact that a belief in rebirth would affect someone who went to university as thinking that, yes, they've been here millions and millions of times, and also a person who was in the corporate world or in a job would be thinking the same thing. I thought there was some implication in that there was some sense of purposelessness about that. Sense of purposelessness about the fact that they realized that they had done this millions and millions of times. Was that your implication?
That was sort of my implication. Want to continue?
That was your implication. Yeah. So I ask you, have you considered that your taking of robes has occurred millions and millions and millions of times? Yeah. And what are the implications of that, considering your...
Okay, well, it just shows that I've not been a good enough monk, right? That's what it shows. Otherwise, I wouldn't be back here again. That's probably the... Yeah, no, that may very well be the case. You may very well be right. But the purpose of this, that just shows you I have failed, basically, as a monastic. If that's the case, I failed in my endeavor to get out of this. Maybe I got it all wrong. Maybe there is no such thing as rebirth. Maybe I have been reborn a million times. Maybe there is no awakening. Maybe there's no getting out of this. I'm not claiming to know these things. I'm claiming this as a confidence on my part. And that is why I follow the monastic path. It is true that I may have done this a million times before, but that, for me, is irrelevant as long as I feel I'm heading in the right direction. One of the most beautiful teachings, one of the teachings I always found so powerful in the suttas, and it's a teaching you don't hear very often, is where the Buddha says that the one thing that you should be concerned about in your practice, whether you're a lay person, whether you're a monastic, how to make decisions in life, you should always ask yourself the question, am I improving in wholesome states and declining in unwholesome states? That is the thing that really matters. And that, because then you are moving in the right direction, right? You're moving towards something more beautiful. You're feeling more at peace, more at ease, more relaxed. Life is more easy. And at the same time, you have more metta, more compassion. All these other qualities come to the fore at the same time. And that is a very beautiful question. And to me, very beautiful statement by the Buddha. And to me, as long as I'm doing that, I know it is going in the right direction. That is what I'm really concerned about at the end of the day. So, with a bit of luck, that might also lead then to the end of rebirth. Please. Nobody should drop out of university. What they should do, my point is just that this is a reflection given by the Buddha. See how that reflection affects you, right? The Buddha says there is rebirth. Some people will reject that. They will say, I can't deal with rebirth. It doesn't make any sense to me. And that's fine. You have to be true to yourself. Okay, so you reject rebirth. Perhaps you reject Buddhism entirely. That's perfectly okay. But my point is just that we need to think about this. The Buddha said this. And then see how it affects our lives. Some people will take it on board, say, yeah, I believe in rebirth. And they will continue on as students or in the corporate world. Because there's no... there's no kind of discordance between the two, right? And they will keep going and they will aim maybe for a good rebirth in the future. Others will take it on board maybe even more and they might drop out and then become monastics. There is no right answer to that. It depends on your reaction to this particular idea given by the Buddha.
So you're wanting the role of the monastic as the highest possible human
not monastic as such. The idea of the monastic path is to give a chance for development to happen. The idea of a monastic, the Buddha said himself, is that you have a vehicle there which is supposed to optimize the causes for having fast progress. That's the purpose of monasticism. It doesn't mean that the monastic is more developed than the layperson. In fact, often it's not the case at all. If you look around the world, there are lots of monastics who are not very, you know, not very admirable at all. And they often do all kinds of things which are completely against the monastic ideal. That's not the point. It's not a comparison of the monastic with the lay people. I meet lots of lay people in my life who are saintly, who are wonderful people. And I know that they are better than 99.9% of monastics. And that's not the point. The point is that monasticism, when it is well lived, gives you, and this is according to the Buddha, according to the early suttas anyway, gives you the optimal way of transcending and moving in the right direction here.
Regarding karma and rebirth, one of the more compelling sort of arguments for karma and rebirth, in my opinion, is the idea that it gives a sense of where things come from. And it also gives a sense of balance in that after there are consequences to actions. We are very familiar with people who do bad things and, you know, nothing happens and whatever, and good people who do nothing but good things and bad things happen. And the idea of karma and rebirth creates a very long-term balance. So it's a very compelling system in terms of understanding causality.
Well, certainly people over the history of Buddhism have no doubt found that to be the case. But I wouldn't argue that it is the only way in which we can achieve such a sense of balance. If you think, for example, in terms of Christianity, let's take an example. A Buddhist couple give birth to a child who is severely ill, is Down syndrome or something. The framework of karma and rebirth gives them a context within which to understand that, to not be freaked out by it, to not be depressed by it, to see that this is the playing out of past actions, and the injunction very much is to then respond compassionately to this situation, in order that in the future this, you know, bad karma, whatever, will be resolved. And so karma and rebirth, again, socially function as providing a deep sense of meaning and purpose within the world. Let's imagine you're a Christian couple. Same situation. They too will appeal to another set of another worldview, in which they will say, we don't understand this, but it must be the will of God. That we have to accept this, we have to live with it as part of God's will, and we will seek this to be the focus for our living according to the teachings of Jesus. We will see Jesus in our child. Now, in both cases, I don't really see why the Buddhist version of events is any more or less compelling or any more or less capable of providing an equivalent sense of balance, as you call it, an equivalent sense of being able to locate that experience within a far greater and wider context of meaning in order to free you from thinking of this purely in terms of my own egotistic inconvenience and frustration. So yes, it does serve that purpose, I agree. And what an equivalent would be in a secular Buddhist world, perhaps that's something we need to think about more deeply. But yes, I agree with that. But again, I think it is common to all religious traditions, will it provide something deeply equivalent. So I'm not sure, to me it doesn't suggest that that version is somehow true, whereas the Christian version is untrue. I think they both function pragmatically in a very similar way.
What I understand is you both were saying the same thing, but in a different way, different wavelengths. What you were saying, Stephen, that Buddha, Asian man, spoke to Asian people, modern man, scientific man, now we are in scientific world. Buddha was talking about the mind. Mind doesn't change. He has said it is what I thought is applicable at all times. So Buddhist practice is about liberation of the mind. Now, both of you mentioned about dependent origination. Now, for this debate, first we have to define what you mean by self. What is your idea of self? When you call it rebirth, it is the self, where you came from, this idea of self, and what happens to the self, what you are trying to do with this idea of self. Nibbana is getting rid of the idea of self. So none of you define this thing called self, which you are talking about, beings born from here and there, and you are talking about a process. So that is the weakness of the debate I saw. Now, various people, according to development of wisdom or practice, do have various views of the separate self. Even if we look at dependent origination, some people will see that as last birth, this birth, and future birth. But the thing is, if you see this self as a aggregates, five aggregates arising, and dependent of origination as a process and phenomena, your argument fits in. If you see that as a self, separate self, his argument fits in. So my question is that, my statement is that if we define self properly, this discussion is become very clear.
Okay. It's often said in Buddhism that there is no self. I find that, again, a somewhat dogmatic assertion, and I feel that it doesn't actually correspond to a great number of canonical sources. Since we're lacking in time, let me just give you one example. Dhammapada, verse 80, where the Buddha says, just as a farmer irrigates a field, just as an arrowsmith fashions an arrow, just as a carpenter shapes a piece of wood, the wise person tames his self or himself. But the word is atanam, accusative. The self is compared to a field that can be irrigated, the parts of an arrow that can be put together and then directed on a target, and a rough piece of wood that can be shaped and fashioned. I don't think that this is a denial of self at all, but it's an understanding that the self is a process, that, in other words, who we are is a process that can be transformed and changed and can evolve from something rough, something unirrigated, something arid, something dry, something disorganized and fragmented that can be put together. And that, for me, is really what this idea of anatta is about. It's about a processual, what we might nowadays call a narrative conception of self, which is not about either affirming the self as being real, nor is it about rejecting the self as being unreal.
Yes, and I think that one of the things that Stephen was saying earlier on in the debate, at the very beginning, that the Buddha's teaching has to be understood in the cultural context of India at the time. It's actually a very important point. The Buddha was obviously limited in the language he used. He had to react to ideas that existed in India at the time, etc., etc. And I think a number of scholars have shown fairly conclusively that a number of the statements made by the Buddha are a direct reaction to the Brahmanical views of the world at the time. So when the Buddha said that, he didn't actually say that in that way, but when the Buddha, what the Buddha was reacting to was the Brahmanical view of the self. And the Brahmanical view of the self was a kind of Satchit Ananda view, Satchit existing mind bliss, the eternal mind which kind of goes on forever and ever. That was the kind of reaction that he had against. So that is when there is a negation of self, that is actually what it means, it seems, in the suttas.
Ajahn Brahmali, in your opening statement, you asserted that there was a connection between the concept of rebirth and each of the Four Noble Truths, but you, I think, did not explain that in your following sort of statement. Would you please do that,
sure,
and then perhaps give Stephen an opportunity to respond to that?
Yeah. Okay. So the most obvious cases where rebirth is mentioned in the Four Noble Truths is obviously the Second Noble Truth, right? The Second Noble Truth says the the tanha, which is porno bhavika, which literally means which has to do with re-arising, re-becoming in the future, is directly in the second noble truth. If you go to the fourth noble truth, the path, it is part of the first one, which is right view. Right view is defined in different ways, but it is, seems to always to have an aspect of rebirth, seems to be an aspect of that right view at the beginning. First noble truth, suffering, remember at birth, jati is said to be suffering, right? So what does jati mean in the first noble truth? It must mean rebirth, because we're supposed to overcome suffering here. The only suffering, the only birth you can overcome is rebirth in the future. You cannot overcome birth in this life. So in the first noble truth, it also must refer to rebirth. In the third noble truth, it says it is the particular craving in the second noble truth that has to be overcome. The craving in the second noble truth has already been defined as a craving which leads to rebirth. So it is implied there as well, directly. So that is how I see rebirth being throughout the four noble truths.
Well, funnily enough, I agree with that. If you think in terms of four noble truths, then when it says that craving is the origin of birth, sickness, aging, and death, then clearly it is the driving force that leads to rebirth, and to eliminate craving is the way, therefore, to eliminate rebirth. I agree with Ajahn Brahmali that if we cannot make sense of the Four Noble Truths, then we probably don't have any business calling ourselves Buddhists. Okay? what I find interesting is that I mentioned briefly that the Noble Truth idea, from philological grounds, could well have been added later. So if that was added later, we take out noble truth, we're not actually talking anymore about four truth propositions. This to me is when Buddhism becomes a belief system. We have life is suffering, cause of suffering is X, end of suffering is Y, da, da. If you accept those propositions which are claimed to be true, then you're a Buddhist. If you don't accept those propositions, you're not. Buddhism is now a belief system. Now, if we suspend the notion of noble truth, we can also suspend the notion we're actually talking about propositions. The latter part of the first discourse, I find actually the bit that people often don't know about. The Buddha says that in the penultimate paragraph of the text, it was not until my knowledge and vision were entirely clear about the 12 aspects of the four noble truths that I could consider myself to have attained a peerless awakening in this world. Now, what are these 12 aspects? This is a teaching that's barely developed in the Buddhist tradition. I think there's lots of ideas like this that were germs that never really bore fruit. But the 12 aspects, briefly, refer to the previous passage in the text, which says that dukkha is to be fully known, tanha, craving, is to be let go of, nibbana, or the stopping of craving, is to be directly experienced, and the path is to be brought into being, is to be cultivated, is to be developed. The recognition, the performance, and the accomplishment of those tasks is what the Buddha then takes to be constitutive of why he calls himself awake. Now, this is not about truth at all here. It's about having completed a task. It's a practice. It's a pragmatic instruction. So I actually suspend the notion of the Four Noble Truths as truths and think of them in terms of tasks. I've written about this elsewhere, but that is, in a sense, what my thinking and my study have led me to, that we're not talking about truths at all. We're talking about injunctions to act in a certain way that culminate in a way of life.
Is it possible that there's a consistency between the two of you in what you're saying, in that we consider dependent origination as the concept, all of the actions of my life will rebound and resonate in future lives being narrative selves, shall we say. So everything I do will come about in some future way, be it through my ancestors or not ancestors. And could that be
definition or a possibility of what rebirth is?
That would be an interpretation, one that I would probably go along with. Again, I think the crucial point of rebirth in many ways is that it provides a vehicle for the continuity and the bearing fruit of the actions that we commit. The core idea for me is not rebirth, but it is the continuity of actions that bear results. Now, if I drop dead tonight, I hope I don't, but if I did, that wouldn't mean that everything I've done up until this point will stop having an effect. It will. And it might go on for an awful long time. And my sense of responsibility in that way is that it's, to me, kind of irrelevant whether these actions rebound on some future me, but rather that they will have an impact on the lives of those who will continue to inhabit this planet after I'm dead.
I certainly agree with what you say. Obviously, it is the case that such a thing happens. You know, we are actually affecting other people. Other people in the past have affected us. There's a continuum there. I agree with that. But I think when you interpret a rebirth and karma in Buddhism, you have to be very careful not to read too much into it. It's actually a very, very hard balance to actually be able to interpret the suttas in accordance with the word of the Buddha and not kind of your own ideas or one's own ideas. It's actually very difficult. And I think we have all made that mistake in the past. And really the only way to move towards and find out what the Buddha actually meant by this thing is to read quite broadly in the most authentic suttas, if you like, of Buddhism. And then after a while, you have like a network of suttas. You can draw it all together and you get a feeling of what it actually means. And for me, having read those things, I don't think the Buddha would deny what you're saying, but I don't think that's what he means by karma and rebirth. When he talks about karma and rebirth, he's literally talking about what you reap in a future rebirth, quite literally. What are the circumstances of that rebirth in the future? Yeah.
So a rebirth couldn't be someone who's, you know, related to me generations ahead or not, who I've affected by my actions in this life?
I'm not sure exactly what you mean now.
What I mean is that I am by my actions connected to future beings, and so that makes sense to me that the rebirth, the concept of rebirth, would be people in the future who are directly affected by me.
No, the idea is actually that it is your mental continuum that moves on into future life.
Thank you.
I would like to make an observation, that is that the debate format is a format which encourages a really dichotomous view of whatever it is that's being discussed. And another thing you have in common is that you're both men, and the debate format arose out of a patriarchal way of being. And maybe what is interesting about tonight is not what has been said or the intellectual aspect of it, but how it's been said. And I've been drawn to the narratives of each of you, and it seems to me that at the centre of all that together is the issue of uncertainty. And, you know, that's described in Buddhism, isn't it, as a great wisdom. You know, the wisdom of uncertainty. And I guess I just wondered what observations you might like to have about that, because it seems to me that the sense of uncertainty is a form of suffering, which you've both either shown or talked about in different ways tonight. So I'd just be interested in that idea of how uncertainty at this moment in time can, you know, lead us into a productive pathway forward.
Okay. Would you like to start? Okay, I will start then. First of all, you're right that it is two men sitting up here, which is, of course, unfortunate. It would be wonderful if we could have one nun and one man, or one woman and one nun, or whatever. Yeah, that would be great in the future. That's certainly true. And it's important to get many voices in there, because people speak differently. A woman would have a slightly different view of the world than a man will have, and it's good to get those voices out there to see all these differences. I agree. And this is, of course, one of the reasons why in Perth we have been very supportive, and the BSV is also very supportive, of having also monastic communities with women as well, because it's needed. You need as many people who practice this path in a good way and who can be teachers as possible. So I fully agree with that. Regarding the idea of uncertainty, it is true. And one of the somewhere in the sutta, I can't remember now where it is, the Buddha says something to the effect that the person who is ignorant but doesn't understand his own ignorance is even more a fool for that reason. But the person who knows their own ignorance are wise, at least to that extent. So there is actually, it's important to understand what you know and what is confidence, and understand the difference. I think it's very important. I think that is true for the idea of rebirth. We shouldn't, as Buddhists, go around and proclaim, I believe in rebirth, as if you believe in Jesus Christ or something like that. It's a different kind of confidence, a different kind of belief. It's more like, I read the suttas and I find them very powerful. I cannot, you know, when a person like that says these things, I have to take it seriously. Or another example would be, you actually meet people, and I have met people in the present day who says there is rebirth to me. People who have a lot of integrity. People who have, when they say it, you can't just put it aside. You have to at least open your mind to these kind of things, right? So these are the sort of things that kind of and gradually strengthen your conviction. And of course, ideally, the point of all this is one day to find out for yourself, to see things for yourself. But in the meantime, what you do is you investigate. You look at these things. Does it make sense? Does it not make sense? And then you evolve around that investigation. And hopefully, you will get closer to the truth in that way.
Yeah, I'd also like to affirm the importance in our world today, and not only in our world today, but in general, that we provide a vision of the Buddhist path that is gender equal. And I think one of the great things of the Buddha that really was a radical departure in his time was the empowerment of women. Women were completely on a spiritual equality to men. And I think it's a great thing that Ajahn Brahm and the community in Perth have done, is to stick their necks out on this and to endorse and to actually create communities for women. But as for uncertainty, I also feel that this is a profoundly important practice. This is perhaps less evident in the suttas themselves, but after I had when I left my Tibetan training, I went and trained in South Korea in a monastery, Songwangsa, where I met Venerable Jigwang Sunim, who is here tonight, a nun. And the practice there was to learn how to rest in a state of perplexity, a state which is focused in that tradition around the idea of great doubt. Of what is this, was the question we asked. And that was the only meditation we did for 3 months in the summer, 3 months in the winter. We sit on a cushion, stare at a wall, and ask, what is this? That was the most powerful practice I think I probably ever did as a monk. And it's not that you then somehow try to become a sort of thoroughgoing skeptic, but is that you acknowledge the fact that fundamentally you do not know what is going on. That the world is fundamentally mysterious. And it's very difficult, I think, for rational Westerners to actually valorize uncertainty. We always want to know the answer. We always want to be right. And this kind of practice, which has been enormously influential in my life, is about learning to not only live with uncertainty, but actually to cultivate uncertainty, to cultivate an ongoing sense of questioning, of curiosity, of astonishment, of perplexity. This is both an act of humility. It's also, for me, an act of devotion, which might sound a bit strange. And it really throws into question every kind of certitude or conviction or belief that you might have. And it touches something very deep. What brings us to Buddhism in the first place is that kind of existential uncertainty. And yet so often, as in all religions, we prefer to substitute belief for what actually was the very living pulse that brought us to that place in the first instance. And so you have a wonderful aphorism that our teacher Kuzan Sunin used to recite all the time. Great doubt, great awakening. Little doubt, little awakening. No doubt, no awakening.
And with that, I'm afraid to say, the inexorable march of time has rolled over these speakers because we are running out of time. I've, like I'm sure all of you, been profoundly moved by the words spoken this evening. I have been inspired by Ajahn Brahmali to invest in the future, which I thought was a very interesting comment. And I also would like to take part in this win-win situation, which Stephen spoke of at one moment. And I'd also like to just comment that it is really a precious time when people can exist in the world and hear about Buddhism. And it's a precious time when they can hear about Buddhism and its dialogue with other traditions. And so that's what we're really being in the presence of here, which is two people, both of whom want to seriously consider Buddhist texts, and both of whom have devoted their lives to the serious investigation of how Buddhism can be understood in the modern world, having this wonderful debate. And it's certainly inspiring, I think, and it leaves you, I hope, with an enthusiasm to explore through practice, through reading Buddhist texts and through reading studies of Buddhist texts and studies of Buddhist practice, the kinds of materials and resources which both of these people would be drawing upon within your own life would be the best thing in many ways, wouldn't it, if we were to leave this room and continue this investigation which we hear being spoken of today.